Okay, so last time we talked about quantum circuits, and so the first thing that I wanted to do today was just talk about one more concept related to quantum circuits, which is this this notion of efficient universality and the equivalence between different different gate sets. So this is an important thing to know about if you want to not have to worry about which gate set you use when you define quantum algorithms, which will be nice. So we won't have to worry too much about which gates we use. And then the main thing that I want to do in this lecture is talk a little bit about potential implementations of quantum computers, just so you have something in the back of your mind when we think about specific quantum algorithms. So this course is really mainly about the theory of quantum information processing, but maybe it's helpful to just have a few things in mind about how you might possibly build a quantum computer and what might actually be made of when you think about what you could do with one. Okay, so let's start with this this thing about efficient universality. So we talked last time about this notion that we wanted to have a finite gate set, and we showed that there was a finite gate set that had the property that it was universal. So it could, in principle, be used to implement arbitrarily closely any unitary operation on n qubits that you might like to do. So we saw one particular gate set, but there are lots of other gate sets that are universal, and you might wonder why you should pick one gate set over another. So, if we're talking about classical circuits, it doesn't really matter what gate set we pick, because whenever you have, first of all, we don't have this notion of approximation for classical circuits. We're just doing everything exactly. And so, whenever you have one gate set that's universal, that has, gates that act on a constant number of bits, you can take those gates and use them to simulate any other gate set. And the overhead in doing that can only be a constant, right? Because you've got some constant size thing, and you've got some other constant size thing that you want to simulate. And if there is a simulation of it, which there is if the gate set is truly universal, then it just takes some constant number of gates to simulate every gate from the new gate set. So there's no issue of what the overhead will be. It will just be constant in converting from one gate set to another. But now if we have quantum gates, things are more complicated, right? Because now our notion of efficiency is that we can only approximately do any operation. And so you could worry that some gate sets are much better at approximating certain operations than others. So it could be, for example, that there's a polynomial time, or you might worry that it could be the case that there's a polynomial time quantum algorithm for factoring using one gate set, but maybe if you take another gate set, then actually there's not a polynomial time algorithm. You would need exponentially many gates using some other gate set, and that would be really a hassle, because then you would have to think carefully about what the complexity of computing things is as a function of the gate set. So it turns out that fortunately that's not the case. It turns out that actually any gate set can simulate any other efficiently, not necessarily with only constant overhead, but with at most logarithmic overhead. Okay, so that's a consequence of the following theorem, which is usually attributed to Solovay and Kataev. And it says the following. So let U be a unitary acting on some constant dimension, some system of constant dimension. Just to keep things simple, let's imagine it's just acting on a qubit, because that'll be sufficient for our purposes. So let's let U be any single qubit unitary. And then let's consider some universal set of gates. So it could be, it could be the H gate and the T gate, which we saw was a universal set for single qubit operations, or it could be any other set of gates that's universal. So consider a universal set of one qubit gates. So here by universal, we're just talking about one qubit. So we just mean you can approximate arbitrarily closely any unitary acting on one qubit. And so there's a technical condition in this theorem, which is that the set should be closed under inverses. So any gate that's in the set, you should be able, the inverse of that gate should also be in the set, or just as well, you should be able to exactly do the inverse of any gate in the set using gates from the set. Okay, so there's this condition that is closed under inverses. So for example, the set of H and T basically has this property. The inverse of H is H, and that's in the set. The inverse of T is not in the set, H and T, but it's, you know, the inverse of t is t to the 7, because t to the 8 is the identity. So that's something that you can do exactly using gates from the set, right? If you do t 7 times, then you can do the inverse of t. And so you could just as well consider the set, you know, of h and t and t inverse. So that's an inverse closed set. And it's what it can do is basically equivalent to what you can do with h and t. So consider a set that has this property, that it's closed under inverses. Then what you can say is that u can be epsilon approximated using, so this is, you know, this notion of approximation is again what we saw last time, that, you know, you can come up with a circuit for something which is within distance epsilon of u, where the distance is the spectral norm of the difference between u and the approximation. U can be epsilon approximated using big O of log 1 over epsilon gates from the universal set. So what this says, I mean, this is pretty nice scaling, right? This says that if you want to have a really small epsilon, you want to have a really good approximation, the number of gates that it takes to do that, the way that grows with decreasing epsilon is only logarithmic. The overhead is only small. And so a consequence of this is that, you know, suppose you want to do a T-gate circuit, and that could even be a T-gate circuit acting on many qubits, but you're going to, approximate all of the single qubit gates in this way. So any T-gate circuit can be, let's say from one universal gate set. So, you know, now we're trying to convert between two universal gate sets. It can be epsilon approximated using, well, let's see, how many gates are we going to need from any other universal gate set? Well, so if we want to take every single qubit gate and approximate it very well, if we wanted to approximate it to within precision epsilon, we would need order log 1 over epsilon gates. Now, if we want to have an epsilon approximation for this entire T-gate circuit, it's not enough to have error at most epsilon for every one of the gates. We might need to have better error for each of the individual gates, because the errors will add up. So something that you can show about this distance measure that I defined before is that the error in an approximation of a product of unitaries is just additive, right? So if you just add up the errors that you get for every individual gate in the approximation, then you'll get an upper bound on the error for the total approximation. So because of that, it's sufficient for every individual gate in the thing being simulated to be approximated with error at most epsilon over t, right? If there's error at most epsilon over t for every one of the gates, then the total error after you do t of these gates will be at most epsilon. So basically what you have is something like this, where you have to take epsilon to be like epsilon over t, and then there's going to be also some factor of t, because you're going to do this for every one of the t gates. So big O of t times log t over epsilon gates from any other universal set. So what this says is, you know, you can't have an exponential overhead in having to convert from one universal gate set to another universal gate set. In fact, you can't even have a big polynomial overhead. Like, you couldn't have a quadratic overhead. You couldn't be forced to incur a quadratic overhead. The worst overhead that you get is logarithmic. So that's really nice, because it says that these quantum speedups that you might see are very robust with respect to the choice of gate set. Even a polynomial improvement, so for example, the one we'll see for Grover's algorithm, even a polynomial improvement would basically remain even if you changed the gate set that you were using in order to realize the quantum circuit. Okay? So this is, you know, we're not going to prove this fact. You know, we're not going to prove this theorem. It would take probably a whole lecture, but it's a good thing to know that it exists, and it means that you don't have to worry about what gate set you use when you're defining quantum algorithms. Okay, questions about this? All right, good. So then the main thing that I wanted to talk about today was implementations. Okay, so now we want to think about how we would actually build some device that would realize this computational model, right? So we have this model of quantum circuits, which are unitary transformations that we can apply to quantum states, and then we perform measurements on those quantum states to get results. Now we want to think about how we could do that using some physical system. If we want to actually build a quantum computer, we're going to have to somehow make some physical device that's actually going to realize this mathematical model that we've talked about. So this is a really hard problem, trying to build a quantum computer. You've probably heard it's, we don't have yet large-scale quantum computers, and it's something that people around the world are trying, trying very hard to do. And in particular, there's not just one technology that people are pursuing, right? So, with classical computers, we've gotten to the point where there's a clear winner for technology, right? I mean, we have silicon chips, microprocessors, which are built using this very highly advanced technology that's been refined over decades. We can pack a lot of transistors onto a chip, and there's just a lot that's known about the engineering of those systems. And it seems like that's really the way to go as far as building classical computers. There is not an analog of that for quantum computers. So it's not like we've settled on one particular technology that we're going to use to build systems. As I'll say later on, there are lots of different things you might consider, maybe like five or six leading contenders, but lots of variations among those different kinds of systems and other kinds of less popular implementations that people consider. So the landscape of different potential implementations of quantum computers is really pretty complicated. So what I want to do first is just talk about some basic conditions that some potential implementation might have to satisfy. And there's this list that people like to talk about of what are called the DiVincenzo criteria. So David DiVincenzo is a theorist who's worked on on various proposed implementations of quantum computers, and he wrote a paper where he talked about what you might like to have in a system that could be useful for quantum computing. And so he had this list of five things that you should be able to do. And this is sort of a basic checklist that you have to go through if you want to think about proposing some implementation of a quantum computer. So this is far from a theorem or something like that, but this is like some rules of thumb for things that you might want to think about if you're trying to build a quantum computer. Okay, so these criteria are the following. So first of all, you should have a system which is defined in some scalable way. So you should have a scalable system with well-defined qubits. So it's very important that you build up your quantum computer in some way that it has a tensor product structure. So you've got individual pieces of the system that represent the individual qubits. And if you want to make a larger system, you can just add more of those things in. So for example, something you would not want to do is maybe say, I'm going to build my quantum computer with one hydrogen atom, and I'm going to use all of the energy levels of the hydrogen atom to store. I take the lowest 2 to the n levels of the hydrogen atom to store the state of my n qubits, right? That would be a very bad idea. You would need to excite very high energy transitions in order to go to general states, and it would just not be a scalable way to do things. So instead, you should have some basic unit that you use to represent each qubit, and those qubits might be systems that are inherently, two-level systems. So you might use, for example, some spin state or a polarization state where you just have two orthogonal states. You might also use just some two-dimensional subspaces. So for example, you could look at the electronic structure of some atom, and you could just pick out two of the levels that are particularly good to use as a qubit. So there are lots of ways to try to, identify those qubits among the state space of some system that you have available to you. But you should have some kind of basic units you can take to be your qubits. Okay. So the second criterion is the following. So you should be able to initialize your system to a pure state. So usually that's, the L0 state. So, the model of quantum computation that we've described so far is one where we're doing everything using pure quantum states, and we'd like to kind of get as close as we can to that ideal. It might be, of course, necessarily in any realistic system, there will be some coupling with the environment that you can't control, and your state will be at least slightly mixed. But you'd like to approximate this pretty well. And as we'll see later on, there are some proposed implementations that violate this pretty badly, and that's usually a big problem. So usually, if you can't do this, in trouble. then you're in trouble. There are some interesting questions about, you know, the power of quantum computation if you're forced to deal with mixed states. But by and large, you would really like to avoid those if you want to build a, you know, a universal quantum computer. Okay. So the next thing is that you should be able to perform a universal set of quantum gates. There should be some way that you can perform some set which is universal. So maybe you can do HT and C0. Or maybe that's not the most natural set of gates to do in the particular system that you have in mind. That's fine. But you should be able to do some universal set of gates. And, you know, we have things like the Soloveitchi-Katayev theorem that say that it doesn't really matter so much what set of gates we have, but you should be able to identify some universal set. So, you know, this may be something that you do using some just naturally occurring, you know, interaction in the system. So, for example, you may be storing information in spin, and then there's some spin-spin interaction that causes the spins to interact with each other. You may somehow be causing it yourself by shining laser pulses on the spins or something like that. But, you know, there should be something that you can do in order to perform a universal set of gates. And one other remark about this, I mean, it's not usually listed as one of the you know, criteria here, but something that you do need to be able to do is to perform gates in parallel. So, you know, we'll talk later on about fault tolerance. In order to have the possibility of doing fault tolerant quantum computing, you really have to be able to do gates in parallel. If you could only do gates sequentially, you could only act with one qubit or two qubit gate at any time, at any step of the computation, then you wouldn't be able to do things fault tolerantly. So it's not enough just to be able to do one of these at a time, but it's a bit more complicated. You have to be able to potentially do gates simultaneously on different parts of the system. Okay. Then something else you need is the ability to measure specific qubits. So you would really like to not only be able to perform some kind of global measurement of like what's the total magnetization of your entire system or something like that, but you'd really like to be able to go in and, you know, for some particular qubit, measure it in the computational basis, say. Now, it's okay in general if, you know, maybe this measurement is destructive. So, it might be that your qubit is not necessarily preserved by the measurement process. It might be that somehow it goes away. Because if you can do these other things, then you can always take the ability to do a destructive measurement that's actually going to get rid of your qubit and turn it into a non-destructive one. Simply because if you have, you know, we can draw a little quantum circuit that kind of describes this. Say you have some qubit psi that you'd like to measure in the computational basis. Well, if we take that qubit and we perform a C0 gate onto a register in the zero state, then, you know, that's like reversible copying in the computational basis. So if we go and measure this qubit, so in these quantum circuits, sometimes if we want to measure a qubit, we draw a little meter at the end of the circuit. So this meter means we're going to measure in the computational basis. And now if we measure this qubit in the computational basis, and maybe we even do that in a destructive way, so there's nothing coming out of the meter, we don't have that qubit anymore, that's the same as measuring this qubit in the computational basis and having the post-measurement state. Right, so because, you know, the information about which computational basis state this qubit is in is correlated with what computational basis state this one was in. So this is really the same as doing the basis measurement here and having the state left over. Okay, but we need to be able to do measurements on specific qubits. And then the last thing that we need is a long coherence time. Or in other words, you know, we need the system to not be too noisy. We need it to not be too strongly coupled to its environment. And, you know, there should be some time scale for this, right? What does long mean? So long means long compared to the gate time. So it'll take some time to do a gate. You can't do gates instantaneously. And this should be long compared to the gate operation time. So, and, you know, there is maybe more specific things you can say about how long it has to be compared to the gate operation time. When we talk more about fault tolerance, you'll see there's this notion of a fault tolerant threshold, where if the, you know, the error rate is low enough compared to, if the error rate is low enough, meaning like the, you know, the amount of error that's applied, I guess you could think about it, per unit time. So, you know, the rate of errors being done per step of the computation when you divide the computation up into discrete steps. If that error rate is low enough, then you'll be able to do things fault tolerantly. And if it's not low enough, then you won't. And that will basically say, you know, how long the ratio has to be before you can do things in a fault tolerant way. So, you know, it'll be something like, you know, the coherence time should be, you know, 1,000 times longer. Well, that would be maybe just at the threshold of what would be good enough. It should be like maybe 1,000 times longer than the amount of time that it takes to do a gate. You'd really like it to be better than that. So you really have to be able to control your systems really well and have very good coherence, well, or extremely fast gates. That would also be good. But you know, there's some kind of trade-off between these two things, and you need to have a big enough separation between them. And that's a big part of the difficulty of building a quantum computer, as we'll see more when I talk about some other implementations. Okay. Any questions about this? Okay, so in order to make this a little bit more concrete, what I would like to do is talk about some specific implementations. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to spend most of the time talking about nonlinear optics, so the idea of doing quantum computing using nonlinear optics. This, I would say, is not one of the leading contenders for a scalable implementation of a quantum computer, because the kind of nonlinearities that you can realize in practice are very weak, and it seems to be hard to build a quantum computer in this way. So I'm describing this implementation not so much because it's a leading candidate for actually being used to build a quantum computer, but because the physics are kind of simple, and there'll be, you know, I think, entirely things that you're familiar with, and I don't have to talk about, you know, trapping ions in magnetic fields or anything like that. We can just kind of talk about some simple optical transformations. So I'm just going to describe this kind of nonlinear optics implementation of a quantum computer, and we can think about how it meets or maybe doesn't meet some of these criteria, what some of the issues are. And then what I'll do at the end of the lecture is put up a table where we'll talk about all of the implementations that people are thinking about these days, or all of the main implementations people are thinking about these days, and how these criteria come into the picture for them, and you know, what we can say about how they relate to each other. Okay, so let's do some nonlinear optics. Well, mostly it's going to be a bunch of linear optics, and then we'll see what you can do with an optical nonlinearity. So the idea here in optical implementations of quantum information, the idea will be that we want to store information in the state of photons. So you know, for example, you could store it in the polarization of a photon, and we're going to store information in some kind of optical mode, and in particular, we can do this. Well, so one way of doing this would be to store information in number states of optical modes. So we could store quantum information in photon number states. So, you know, the state of some optical mode could be written in general as follows. So we have some quantum state, which is, so now we have, you know, not a finite dimensional Hilbert space, but one where we could have any number of photons in principle in an optical mode. And so we have, you know, some amplitude Cn for our mode to have n photons in it. Okay, so this n is just the number state, you know, with n photons, right? This is just like the state of a harmonic oscillator, and you can have any number of excitations in it. Okay, so now what we could do is we could store a qubit in this thing, and maybe the most natural way to store a qubit would be to use the 0 and 1 states, say. I mean, maybe it's hard to make the states that have a lot of photons in them, so maybe the simplest thing to do would be just to use the vacuum and the single photon state. So we could, if we like, store a qubit as, you know, C0 times 0 plus C1 times 1. So that would be something that we could do. But there's actually a problem with this. So this is not the way that people would normally think about storing quantum information in some kind of optical implementation. The reason for that is that, you know, we have conservation laws to worry about. And you know, photon number is something which is hard to change. And so if you wanted to do transformations, you know, the sorts of transformations that are easy to do will be ones that will preserve the photon number. But if we want to do, say, a NOT gate that's going to map between these two states, we would have to change the number of photons. So that's sort of a problem we would like to get around. And fortunately, there's a simple thing that we can do to avoid that issue, which is to use what's called a dual rail encoding. And so in a dual rail encoding, what we'll do is we'll use two optical modes, and we'll store our information in whether the photon, so we'll have a single photon state, we'll have just one photon in the system, and the quantum information will be in which mode the photon is in. So now we have our two modes, and we'll have like, you know, C0 times 0,1 plus C1 times 1,0. So this is a two-mode state with one photon. And now if we want to do, let's say, an X gate, then what we have to do is just move the photon between the modes. So that's a much easier thing to do than some kind of transformation that's going to make a superposition of you know, two different numbers of photons, or that's going to change the photon number. It's an easier thing to do in a coherent way. Okay? So this is the kind of encoding which is more commonly used. Now, these modes could be different things. This could be, for example, you know, the two modes could be the horizontal and the vertical polarizations of a single photon, and you could be, you know, just rotating the polarization of the photon in order to do a NOT gate. You could even have different spatial modes, so you could, you know, just have some fixed polarization and the photon is in two different places, depending on whether you're encoding a 0 or a 1. You know, there are different options available to you in terms of how you lay things out, and these would presumably have, you know, consequences for what you, you know, what would be hard or what would be easy to do in an experiment. Let's maybe not worry about those details too much. You know, if you like, you could think about, say, you know, photon polarization. Okay. So now this is, you know, this is an encoding that you could use in order to store optical information. But now, you know, so this would be some way of having well-defined qubits, right? So we've sort of fulfilled the first condition that we could you know, if we have two optical modes, we can use that to store one qubit. And now, if we want to have, you know, two qubits, now we need to have four optical modes, et cetera, right? We just need to have two n optical modes if we want to store n qubits. So that's you know, that's something which seems like it ought to be tractable. So this condition, I guess, we can more or less check off. So the next thing we would have to do is we would have to be able to initialize our system, right? So what does that mean if we use this encoding? Well, it means we have to be able to create single photon states, right? We would have to be able to create a state where you have one photon in some mode, or, you know, maybe we also want to be able to create the vacuum state, right? We want to be able to make a state which is in the pure quantum state that says definitely we're in the vacuum, or definitely we have one photon. And this is a pretty hard thing to do. But there is a way of doing this that people do actually carry out in optical experiments, which is based on a technique which is called parametric down conversion. So this is the next thing we want to see about making single photons. So there's this thing called parametric down conversion. So, you know, I should say, like, I am a theorist who thinks mainly about quantum algorithms and not so much about the physics of these systems. Aggie, on the other hand, I think knows a lot about, you know, quantum optics, and maybe she would be a good person to follow up with if you have more specific questions about how exactly these kinds of things work. But I'll give you the basic idea. So in parametric down conversion, what you do is you have some kind of a nonlinear medium. And this will actually be exactly the same sort of thing that we'll use in order to do two-qubit gates later on when we talk about you know, doing a universal set of quantum gates. But so for now, we're talking about just using this thing for you know, our initialization. So this is something which is called a nonlinear crystal, or sometimes it's called a Kerr medium. And this is a material which will facilitate interactions between photons, right? So for the most part, photons don't want to interact with each other so much, but you can make a material system that will cause the interactions between them to be stronger. And so what you can do is you can have one of these crystals, and you shine some beam of light on it. So you have you know, a laser, and then something that can happen is that if you have you know, a beam of photons incident on this thing, occasionally there will be events where one photon splits into two photons. Okay, and then what you can do is have a detector somewhere. So this is a photodetector, which will you know, detect when a photon arrives, and, you know, because of this process So this process will occur, you know, so the strength of the nonlinearity in materials that you can usually build is quite weak. So this will only happen fairly rarely. But when you get a click at this detector, then you'll know that you had created this two-photon state. I mean, there's also some possibility of creating, you know, three photon states and higher photon states due to higher order effects of this nonlinearity, but that's going to be extremely unlikely because even the process where you create two photons is going to be something which is fairly weak. So usually what happens if you detect a photon here is that this thing split into two photons. And because of momentum conservation, you'll know what the properties are of this other photon. And now you can take this other photon and use it as your single photon state. So this is maybe not really exactly what you would like in order to have a source of single photons, because it's not like you get the photon out on demand, right? It's not like you press a button and out comes a single photon. That's what you would really like to have. You know, you would line up many of these devices and you press all the buttons at the same time and you get the single photon states that you need in order to create your logical encoding of the all zero state, right? Which would mean, you know, like in every other mode you have exactly have a single photon. So that's not exactly what this thing does. You know, you turn it on and you sort of wait a while, and at some time that you don't get to choose, you get this single photon state out. So there's some issue associated with that, and then there are, you know, maybe techniques for trying to deal with that. But at least this is some way of creating single photon states. And so you could imagine that in principle, you could at least create the kinds of states that you like, and you could do something like this in order to create the initial state for your quantum computation. Okay? So let's imagine that you know how to do something like this, and certainly there are kind of technical details to worry about, but let's imagine that you can do this very well, and then you can use this to create the initial state to create the logical encoding of your initial pure state input, right? So the logical encoding of the all zero state, again, is the one where, like in every other mode, you have a single photon state. Okay. So now what we would like to do, so we've sort of done number two. I mean, there's this issue about in this implementation being able to create these things when you want them, but let's put that aside for now and go on and think about how we would do a universal set of gates, right? So we'd like to be able to do some transformations on these optical modes that allow us to perform a universal set of gates. And we've fixed our encoding, so we have to be able to do our gates in a way that preserves this encoding, so that maps states in this encoding to other states in this encoding, in such a way that we do a universal set of gates. Okay, so the simplest operations that we can do on these photon states are ones that involve what are called linear optics. So the simplest operations to do are linear optics. So these operations are called, the operations that are called linear optics are the things which perform linear transformations on the creation and annihilation operators, if you think kind of in the Heisenberg picture, right? So we have these, creation operators. So a dagger acting on the number state n gives us root n plus 1 times the number state n plus 1, and a acting on n gives us root n times the state n minus 1. If we consider linear optical transformations, those are the things that would map a dagger and a to linear combinations of them. And we could more generally have, multimode linear optical transformations that would map multiple, the creation and annihilation operators for multiple modes, again, to linear combinations of them. And the Hamiltonians that will generate such things will be quadratic in the creation and the annihilation operators. So we could have some operations that would behave in this way, that would be linear optics. And so let's see how far linear optics will get us, because these are the things that are easy to do in the lab. You can build easy kind of passive optical devices that will perform these linear optical transformations. And so we'd like to see how far that will get us. Okay, so one simple transformation you could do in linear optics is what's called a phase shifter. And so the Hamiltonian that will describe a phase shift being applied to a system is really just free evolution, right? So the Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator is just the number operator. So this is like, h bar omega a dagger a, if we have a single optical mode. So this is just free evolution that's going to give us a phase shift. And you can do this just by, say, you know, you've got some beam, and you just put in some material with a different index of refraction, and so the phase is going to accumulate in a different way when the light passes through that material. Okay. So you know, if you do this and you have some number state n, then what's going to happen? Well, you know, the evolution according to this Hamiltonian will be e to the minus I times h bar omega a dagger a times t, if you evolve with this thing for time t, acting on the state n. And you know, the number state n is just an eigenstate of this thing. So this is just going to give us e to the minus I times h bar omega t times n. So we're just going to accumulate some phase. This is just we're just in some eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And so what this means is that if we have a zero state, if we have the vacuum state, then, well, nothing is going to happen. We're not going to get any phase. But if we have a single photon state, then we're going to get some phase. And by choosing the amount of time that we evolve, we could accumulate different phases. Okay, so now we want to see what kind of a transformation this gives us if we do this on our logical encoding, right? And how are we going to do this on our logical encoding? Well, let's say that we have two modes that are involved in our dual rail encoded qubit. And so what we could do is we could have a phase shifter for the first mode and not for the second mode. So say we do this, then what's going to happen? Well, the state 0, 1 is going to be, let's see, I guess, which I may have done things backward in my notes. So I guess we want the phase to be applied. Yeah, OK, this is right. So 0, 1. So if I'm in the state 0, 1, that means I have no photons here, and I have one photon here. And so now there's going to be no relative phase. So that's just going to get mapped to 0, 1 under this evolution. But if I'm in the state 1, 0, now I have one photon here, and I have no photons here. And so the one photon here is going to pick up this phase, and I'm going to get an e to the minus I h bar omega t times 1, 0. Right? So that's how my logical states are going to evolve when I have this kind of optical transformation. And so what you see is that this is exactly a z rotation, right? This is, if we think in terms of the Bloch sphere, where, remember, 0, 1 is the logical state corresponding to 0, and 1, 0 is the logical state corresponding to 1. So in the Bloch sphere picture, this is a rotation about the z-axis, because it's a relative phase between the two computational basis states. So this is a z rotation. And by, you know, varying the something that's going to vary the phase, like varying the thickness of this material or varying the index of refraction, you can perform rotations by different angles. And you know, we could basically perform any rotation by any angle that we like. So you know, probably for reasons of fault tolerance, we don't want to do arbitrary rotations by trying to continuously vary this thickness in a really accurate way. But we could perform some fixed z rotation. You know, we could vary it in such a way that we can do some fixed z rotation that we would like to do. So you know, for example, we could do a T gate. By choosing the parameters to be right. And we'd have to try to do that thing accurately enough that we can do the overall thing in a fault-tolerant way, but you know, we could try to do that. Okay. All right, good. Any questions so far? Okay. So this is one simple linear optical transformation that you can do. Another one that you can do is using what's called a beam splitter. So this is now going to be a transformation that's going to involve two optical modes. So in a beam splitter, we have some piece of material, which is like a half-silvered mirror, right? So you have a piece of glass, and you deposit. So if you deposited a lot of metal on it, then it would just become a mirror. But you kind of deposit enough that some of the light will reflect, and some of the light will be transmitted. And then what you can do is you can have a transformation between optical modes. So let's say we consider a mode described by the annihilation operator A, corresponding to the light coming in this way and going through this way. And we have a mode with an annihilation operator B that corresponds to the light coming in this way and then later on going out this way. And now the Hamiltonian that's going to describe the interaction at the beam splitter is, so there's going to be some coupling constant times A B dagger plus A dagger B. So it's going to be an interaction between these two modes. And this is just going to give you the kinds of dynamics that you would expect, where, you know, if you have a photon coming in this way, then there's going to be some amplitude for it to be transmitted and also some amplitude for it to be reflected and some relative phase between those two processes. And, you know, to figure out what that is, you can solve the, you know, the Schrodinger equation. I mean, you figure out what the dynamics are when you evolve with this Hamiltonian. So now what we can do in order to see how this would act on our logical qubit, we could imagine doing a beam splitter on the two modes of our dual rail encoding. Right, this is something that we could do if we took, you know, this to be the input mode corresponding to the first mode of the encoding, and this to be the input mode for the second mode of the encoding. You know, then we could just sort of work out what happens. So let's work out now the action on dual rail states. So if we have, you know, let's just see what this particular, you know, quadratic function of these creation and annihilation operators, how it acts on the dual rail states, and then we'll be able to see what the Hamiltonian is in this logical space, and you know, then it'll be kind of clear how the thing is acting. So A times B dagger plus A dagger B acting on the first logical state, so the state 0, 1, what is that going to give us? Well, you know, there's two terms here, right? So the first one would try to remove a photon from the first mode. But that's just going to give us 0, right? Because we can't annihilate a photon where there isn't one. So this term acting on this term is just going to give us 0. And then here, what we're going to get is, you know, we're going to create a photon in this mode and remove a photon from this mode. And there are also these coefficients in the, you know, creation and annihilation operators. But those coefficients are just 1 here because we happen to have a single photon state. So this is just going to give us the state 1, 0. And similarly, if we do the same thing, I mean, I guess you can just see by symmetry that it has to be this way. If you go the other way, then the photon is going to be moved in the other way. So what that says is that what this beam splitter Hamiltonian does is exactly an x-gate, right? Or rather, I mean, this Hamiltonian is acting as the x operator, which is the generator of rotations about the x-axis in the Bloch sphere picture, right? So this acts as x. So what that says is that it generates x rotations. So now what we can see is that we can actually do a universal set of single qubit gates using just phase shifters and beam splitters, right? So in this logical encoding, in this dual rail encoding, we can do now rotations about Z, and we can do rotations about X. And if we choose our rotations to be about appropriately chosen angles, then this can actually give us a universal set of gates, right? So I mean, we don't have a Hadamard gate in here, but you could figure out how to write a Hadamard gate as the product of some rotations about the x-axis and some rotations about the z-axis. In general, any rotation can be decomposed about as rotations about, you know, just say some rotation about the z-axis, then some rotation about the x-axis, and then some rotation about the z-axis. There's this Euler angle decomposition that you're probably familiar with. So by choosing the angles in the right way, we can get this to realize the gates that we want to do. And now we have a universal set of single qubit gates. So that was pretty easy. We just did simple linear optical transformations, and we got a universal set of single qubit gates. So that's nice. But then the last thing that we need to do is, you know, have some two qubit gate, right? In order to have a universal set of gates acting on n qubits, we need to add, let's say, a C0 gate. So that would be kind of the last thing to do. So it turns out that actually, if we only consider things that you can do using linear optics, it's not possible to do that. So you can show that you can't do a C0 gate. And in general, it's just not possible to do universal quantum computing, so to do a universal set of gates using only the unitary transformations that you can implement by linear optics. So we have to somehow go beyond linear optics in order to be able to do things in a universal way. And a way that we can do that is exactly to use one of these nonlinear media, some nonlinear crystal. So to get interactions, now, of course, we could possibly change the encoding to something else. That would be another choice, right? We don't have to use this encoding. And if we use some other encoding, it could be that maybe you know, two-qubit gates would be easy, but then single-qubit gates would be hard. So in general, there's going to be some kind of a trade-off. But in this kind of encoding, we're going to have to do something nonlinear in order to get interactions. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Can you say, is there any quick way to say why that's the case?
I'm not sure that I can say quickly why it's the case. There is sort of a workaround, which I'm going to say something about later on. So there's a sense in which you actually can do something interesting using linear optics. But yeah, I mean, somehow the space of operations that you can do using only linear optics, you know, just isn't enough. But it's a somewhat tricky thing to try to formalize, right? Because there is this freedom in terms of, you know, what kind of encoding you might choose. So if you just wanted to show that you couldn't do it in this encoding, I mean, basically these are the only, you could write arbitrary, so you can think about these beam splitters and phase shifters as basically generating all linear optical transformations. And then, you know, if these are the only operations you can do, there's just, you know, some small set of things you could try in this encoding, and you could just see that none of them would work. But something that would be harder to see, I guess, would be that, you know, no matter how you choose to encode your logical qubits, still you wouldn't be able to be universal. I'm not sure that I have a good answer for you right now.
It seems like, I mean, linear optics is just, presumably just means the set of optical transformations that are linear, right?
Yeah, so there'll be, I mean, one way to specify what they are is exactly the things you can do using beam splitters and phase shifters. So, I mean, there are also interesting questions about, for example, you know, what is the computational power of things you can do using beam splitters and phase shifters, using linear optics? And there is actually some evidence that there are things, you know, things that you could do using linear optics that would be hard to do using a classical computer. But at the same time, they don't seem to be universal for quantum computation. So. Okay, but so what we're going to do in order to get a universal set of gates is we're going to add an optical nonlinearity. So this is something that in principle you could do. The problem is just that the kinds of nonlinear optical media that you can actually build have such a weak nonlinearity that this, you know, wouldn't really work very well in practice. But in principle, you could do this. So it's, you know, it's really going to be the same kind of effect that as in parametric downconversion, and the kind of the Hamiltonian that describes the interaction that takes place in this medium. If you just restrict your attention to the two modes that are participating in some particular process, is, you know, that you've got some coupling constant times something like A dagger A times B dagger B. So you have the product of the number operators for the two modes that are interacting. So, you know, maybe it's a little bit unsatisfying, to see me just write down the Hamiltonian and say this is what the Hamiltonian is. In principle, you could derive this thing from some description of the microscopic physics and see how it is that the material facilitates this particular kind of nonlinear interaction between the photons. We're not going to do that because that's sort of like a whole other course on quantum optics. But let's just see what would happen if you had some system in which this is the Hamiltonian. Well, if we have a 0-0 state, so we're going to look at what happens to two optical modes that are in, you know, where each of the photons is either in the 0 state or the 1 state. It's either in the vacuum state or the single photon state. We're not just going to restrict attention, though, to the states where we have, states of the logical encoding, because when we apply this, these are going to be two modes out of four modes in the encoding of two qubits, right? So if you just look at two modes out of the encoding of two qubits, it could be that they're both in the zero state, for example, because they could be taken from the encoding of two different logical qubits, right? So so we do have to look also at states like this. So, you know, 0-0, if we act with A dagger A times B dagger B, well, this is just going to get mapped to 0-0 because, you know, there's zero photons in both of them. And in fact, for any state where we have zero, where we have the vacuum for one or the other of the modes, it's not that it's preserved, it really just gets mapped to zero, right? This state just gets annihilated by this operator. And really, any state that has vacuum for either of the modes is just going to get annihilated because one or the other of the operators is going to give you zero when you act in the state. So if we're in the state 1-0, that's also going to send us to just the zero vector. But if we have 1-1, well, then there's you know, then the number is 1 for both of the things, and so the state is just preserved. Right? So this is how this operator will act on our on these four states, on these four number states of two modes. And so what you can think of is that, you know, acting on the two modes, what this gives you is a controlled phase gate. Right? So this gives a controlled phase gate on the two modes. So not on a logical encoding, but now just on the two modes. So you know the matrix that you get when you exponentiate this thing will be something that looks like 1, 1, 1, and then you'll have some phase down here, right? So e to the minus I chi times t. So this is the operation that will be applied if you evolve with this Hamiltonian on this four-dimensional subspace for time t. And now what you can do is, you know, you can take two modes and you can act on, if you act on one mode from the logical encoding of the first qubit and the other mode from the logical encoding of the other qubit, then what you'll find is that what you'll do is exactly a gate that's described by this matrix, but now on the logical encoding of the two qubits. So in fact, you can actually perform this gate on the logical two-qubit state, right? So, so we can also perform this on the logical encoding of two qubits, which is described by some four-mode state, right? But you know, you're doing this on two particular modes in such a way that that you perform this gate. So this is a gate which we might write, so we would draw it like this. It's like, you know, e to the minus I chi t times the z gate. So this is like a controlled z rotation. And now what I claim is that, you know, as long as you don't choose the parameter chi times t badly, like if you took it to be 0, that wouldn't be so interesting because you'd just be doing the identity. But as long as you take it to be something non-trivial, then this is going to give you a universal set of gates. So you know, one thing that you can show actually is that if you can do arbitrary single qubit gates, and you can do any two qubit gates that gate that's entangling, so it has the property that it maps some product state to an entangled state, then that will give you a universal set of gates. But you know, a more specific thing that you could see would be, for example, that if you can do a controlled Z gate, so a controlled, you know, so in other words, where this phase down in the bottom right corner is minus 1, so that the operator in that box is just the operator Z. So this is going to be, so if we can do like a controlled Z gate, well, this is up to Hadamard gates on the second qubit. This is the same thing as a controlled knot, because you know, Hadamard times Z times Hadamard is just X, right? So Hadamard is the operation that transfers you between the eigenbasis of the Z operator and the eigenbasis of the X operator. So that says that, you know, if I do this, then that's the same thing as doing a C knot. So if I can do Hadamard gates, which I can do if I can do a universal set of single qubit gates, and I can do controlled Z gates, then I can do C knot gates. Okay, so you know, this kind of interaction is just as good as being able to do a controlled knot, basically. Okay, so as I mentioned, the problem with trying to do this in practice is that, you know, it's going to be hard to do rotations by big angles here because this optical nonlinearity is going to be very weak. And so in practice, what you can do by doing something like this is some gate that's very close to the identity, and you know, and that's going to mean that there's going to be some big overhead in being able to actually apply, you know, strong interactions in order to really do you know, gates like where you really do a controlled knot, say. So this is a very hard thing to do in practice, and that's the reason why this doesn't seem to be a leading candidate. But there are alternatives. So as I was mentioning, if you have linear optics, that's not enough by itself to do universal computation. But there's this very nice idea that's due to Knill, Laflamme, and Milburn that says that if you can do if you can perform measurements on your single qubit gates, single qubit states. So that's something you would also have to do in this implementation anyway, right? In this nonlinear optics, you would also have to be able to measure the final state and figure out for each mode is there zero photon, are there zero photons or one photon in order to figure out what the you know, readout should be. But so if you can do that not only at the end of the computation, but if you can do that at intermediate stages of the computation and then decide what linear optics to do later on the basis of the measurement outcome that you got, actually that is sufficient for doing universal quantum computation. So if you have linear optics and you have this adaptive measurement, and then you do later linear optics conditioned on what measurement outcomes you got, that actually will be sufficient for universal computation. It's you know, kind of non-trivial to see that that's the case, but that turns out to be the case. So that is some other potential you know, route to building a quantum computer where you wouldn't have to use this sort of optical nonlinearity, except maybe in the preparation of the initial states. But that's maybe something that you could do kind of offline in some way that you wouldn't have to worry so much about the low rate of creating photons. And then if you had good detectors and you had very fast electronics, so you could do you know, your later operations conditioned on the measurement outcomes that you saw, then potentially you could build a quantum computer in this way. Again, probably a very hard thing to do, but it's another alternative. Okay, any questions about this? Yes.
Yeah, so certainly there are examples of candidates of kind of tasks that you could do with only linear optics. They couldn't probably do with a classical computer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, so I mean, I can tell you what I meant by that. So there's a very specific you know, thing that's been proposed, which is what goes by the name of boson sampling. So this is something that was proposed by Scott Aronson and Alex Arkhipov. And there's this idea of kind of, you know, if you take so, you know, the problem that you can solve in this way is maybe not one that you want to solve, but it's something that maybe where maybe you can show some kind of computational separation. So, you know, the idea is that you create some initial input state, you run it through some linear optical network, and then you just want to perform the measurement that the perform a measurement that would give you the statistics of the bosons if you were to measure them all in the number state basis, right? So, in other words, the problem is just to figure out what a linear optical network would do if you gave it some input state that consisted of single photons. And now, so there is some reason to think that it's possibly, you know, that it may be hard to do that classically. Even so, you know, of course, if you build the experiment, then it's not going to do it perfectly. There'll be some approximation. And there's a lot of technical issues that come into trying to show that it would be hard for a classical computer even to get the kind of approximation that a realistic experiment could get. But you know, that's sort of the basic idea, and I could give you a reference to the you know, some of the relevant papers. This is kind of a hot topic these days. Okay, so the last thing that I wanted to do was just give a little survey of some of the proposed implementations. You know, so I've really told you mainly about this one, which as I said, is you know not really a leading candidate anyway. So I'd like to list some of the other implementations that people have thought about and say something about the advantages and disadvantages of them in light of these DiVincenzo criteria. So this is not going to be an exhaustive list, and you know, I'm maybe not really the best person to tell you about implementations anyway, so I'm just going to try to give you a kind of a rough picture of what's going on, and I'd be happy to talk with you more later about maybe where you might go to learn more about other possibilities. Okay, so I'm going to make a table where I list a bunch of implementations, and I'm going to order them by the gate time, so the amount of time that it takes to do to do some operation, some logical operation between qubits or a single qubit gate on qubits. And generally speaking, you know, there are going to be implementations which are faster than others in terms of the amount of, you know, well, the time scale in which you can do a gate. But, as I mentioned before, the thing that matters as far as this condition 5 is concerned is not so much what the absolute gate time is. I mean, of course, you would, all things being equal, you would like the gate time to be as fast as possible. But what you really need is a separation between the gate time and the coherence time. So you want the coherence time to be long compared to the amount of time it takes to do a gate. And generally speaking, the implementations for which you can do gates faster will also be ones where you have faster decoherence. So if you can do fast gates, it's probably because you have some strong coupling to the system. But maybe also then the system tends to have a stronger coupling to its environment, And so, you know, quantum information will leak out faster than it might otherwise. So so I guess I'm going to just go over a little bit, because I guess we should probably try to get through this so we can move on to other things next time. So I'm just going to try to kind of quickly fill out this table. And I'll try not to go more than, you know, 5-10 minutes. OK, so so the first thing that I'm going to talk about is nuclear magnetic resonance. So this would have maybe the slowest gates of the kinds of implementations that I'm going to talk about. So here, the quantum information would be stored in the state of some nuclear spins in some molecules. Those spins could be, you know, you take some nuclear spins that can point either up or down, and you can use that to encode a qubit. So now the qubits could be nuclear spins. And what are the interactions going to be in these systems? So the, you know, the single qubit gates can be performed by you know, using RF pulses on resonance. So that's where the R and NMR comes from. So you have some you apply some RF pulses that are in resonance with the frequencies of these nuclear spins, and that will cause them, you know, say, to want to flip over, and you can perform single qubit gates in that way. The way you get interactions between different qubits is through the dipolar coupling between these nuclear spins. So just the spin-spin interaction. Now, there are different ways that you might try to do NMR. So one way of doing it is in the liquid state, where you have molecules in solution that are, you know, tumbling around. And this is the kind of implementation where you know, the most has been done. So there's even been an experiment where, in some sense, the number 15 was factored by running something like Shor's algorithm. I guess we knew what the answer was before we did the experiment, but it was some kind of proof of concept. So you know, this is the implementation in which you might say at some level, you know, at some level there are the most qubits that have been realized. Maybe that's becoming less and less true as time goes on, but 5 years ago, that was probably true, that it was the kind of implementation where really people had the most qubits. But there's a problem with this implementation, which is that in a liquid state system, well, you know, the system has to be pretty warm. Otherwise, the liquid freezes. So the temperature of these things is actually pretty high. And actually, the initial state is very highly mixed. So it's really not the case that in these systems you can implement things using a pure state. There are some ways of getting around that, but the ways of getting around that generally are not scalable. So they don't allow you to create arbitrarily large systems. And that's the reason why we don't think we can actually build a large-scale quantum computer using at least liquid-state NMR. So it's possible also to do NMR in solid state, and perhaps something can be done there, but maybe there are other problems associated with that. OK, so that's one sort of regime in which we could do implementations. So moving to some implementations that have faster gate times, we could think about trapped ion quantum computing. So in ion trap quantum computing, the idea is that we have quantum information which is stored in well, something associated with ions, which are trapped in magnetic fields. And we would use, let's say, the electronic levels. So that, you know, the states of the electrons in these trapped ions. Now again, we can apply pulses in order to excite or de-excite, you know, the electrons in these levels, and thereby perform single qubit gates. So we can do that just by firing laser pulses. And a way you can perform interactions between these things is through a phonon mode. So you can have you know, you trap these ions in some magnetic trap, and there are oscillations of the ions relative to each other. And if you make the thing really cool, then, you know, that phonon mode can itself be quantum mechanical, and you can coherently put quantum information into the oscillations of the ions relative to each other. And by using laser pulses in the right way, you can facilitate, you know, having that phonon mode exchange quantum information between different qubits, between different ions. So that's a system, that's another kind of system in which you can try to process quantum information, and this is one of the implementations which is also fairly far along. So it's, you know, it's one of the implementations where where things are quite well developed. One of the reasons for that actually is that there was a lot of technology developed for using trapped ions to build very good atomic clocks. Some of the best atomic clocks are built using the same ideas. And so actually Dave Wineland, along with Serge Roche, won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago for some of the ideas that go into building these trapped ions. And the original reason for, one of the original reasons for trying to do that was actually to build very good atomic clocks. But some of the same issues that come in trying to build very good, establish very good frequency standards are the same kinds of things you have to worry about for quantum computing. So also in this kind of microsecond timescale, there's this idea of optical lattices, where you have neutral atoms, which are trapped not in magnetic fields, but in kind of counterpropagating laser. So you have lasers which are shining in different directions, and you create some kind of egg crate potential in which these neutral atoms would like to sit. And now you can again store information in the electronic levels of these systems. You can perform interactions by bringing atoms together, and there's just some collisional interaction between them. And this is some other way of performing quantum computation. A problem with this kind of implementation is that often it's difficult to selectively address individual atoms in these traps. But one thing which has been suggested about using these systems would be to use them to build kind of analog quantum simulators for simulating, models of condensed matter physics or something like that, doing some kinds of analog quantum simulations that maybe you wouldn't be able to do on a classical computer, but you also wouldn't need a full quantum computer to realize. Okay, so moving to somewhat faster timescales, if we go to like nanosecond timescales, a system that people think about is what's called superconducting qubits. And there are different ways of trying to encode quantum information in superconducting devices, which are devices built using superconducting electronics on microchips. You could try to encode information in the charge, or the flux, or the phase of some system of superconducting electronics, and depending on which kind of encoding you use, the qubits would be stored in different ways, either in the location of some Cooper pair, the direction of some magnetic flux, or in some superconducting phase. This description basically tells you how the qubit would be stored. So for example, for flux, it would be the direction of the flux. That's what the qubit would be, is the current propagating in a clockwise direction or a counterclockwise direction. And the interactions would be performed in this system using some kind of a nonlinear inductor. Using something called the Josephson junction. So these are systems in which you can perform. Much faster gates. But associated with that is often a faster decoherence time. And understanding the nature of the decoherence in these systems is a quite difficult thing. But this is also an implementation where things are pretty far along, and it seems like a fairly promising. Potential application of or potential way to build a quantum computer. So there are three groups at IQC, for example, that are all working on superconducting qubits, and lots of groups around the world that are working on these kinds of ideas. And then last, let me just mention one other potential implementation where you have even faster gates using what are called quantum dots. So these are sort of like artificial atoms. So these are also semiconductor kinds of systems that you could build, where you could have some kind of system where you have maybe two islands where electrons could be, and you could have an electron on one island or the other, and you could use that to store the state of a qubit. So the information would be stored like in electron spin, and you can also have information encoded in where the spins actually sit. So now you can perform interactions between these spins using the exchange coupling from the exclusion principle. And doing this, you can perform extremely fast gates. But again, associated with this is even faster decoherence times. So you have typically quite short lifetimes for your quantum information. So So that's sort of like a very rough overview of what some of the main implementations are. There are definitely others that I didn't mention, but this gives you some sort of feeling for the lay of the land. And you know, there's a lot of progress that's taking place all the time. But alas, probably it will also be it will still be kind of a while before we have a very large scale quantum computer. Okay, so sorry to go a bit over. I guess maybe I should stop there. Are there any questions? Yes. I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, you know, I guess I like, you know, of these things, I would say probably ion traps and superconducting qubits. If I could pick two, would seem like the two leading contenders. You know, one of the advantages of superconducting qubits, of course, is that they're, you know, the kinds of systems that you would use to build these things involve somewhat similar technologies to, you know, what we use to build classical microprocessors. So there's a lot of technology that's been built up that maybe you could reuse. But of course, there are lots of new issues that come in when you try to build quantum stuff. And there's, you know, more than just making the qubits. There's all the control electronics. And I'm really the wrong person to ask because I'm really somewhat far removed from experiments. But I would say, you know, these two implementations would be the ones that I would see as the two leaders. Other questions? Okay, so next time we'll talk a bit about computational complexity, and also I guess you probably announced this already, but tomorrow there are going to be two lectures.
Yes, there's a lecture at 3:30 as well.
So there'll be a lecture at the usual time, and then a second lecture at 3:30, because we have to cancel one later on. Yeah. Okay, so see you tomorrow.